Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Music is universal to humankind, yet there are profound differences in music between cultures. You started playing piano in Montana at 4, had special talent. In 8th grade, you got the prized Cook Scholarship to St. Paul's Prep School, then on to Harvard, where you studied music and comparative religion. A 5-month fellowship took you to India, exposing you to greater depth between culture and music. And for 5 years, you've worked as an arranger and conductor in New York City. That's quite a ride for a 31-year-old, Kurt Crowley. What has he learned along the way? Kurt, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with the beginning. Helena, learning the piano. Where did that come from?
I started in an early music class when I think I was 3 years old, learning the very fundamentals, how to keep a steady beat, what the human voice sounded like. And I, from the story my parents tell me, within a few months to a year of that, the teacher said he needs to start on an instrument, something more concrete. My parents had a piano, as many people do, and so I started on the piano, and I haven't stopped.
What's the level of interest in music of your parents? What do they do?
My father is an attorney here in Helena. My mom worked for state government. She had studied piano growing up. I think it was her piano that she'd inherited that was in the house. My father has a beautiful singing voice and has played guitar and sang in the cathedral choir here in Helena. They've always been very supportive of music in the house, but I would say they, you know, encouraged me to start music, not necessarily knowing how far it would take me.
Any brothers and sisters?
I have an older sister.
Any particular interest in music on her end?
We started piano lessons at the same time, actually, and she, quickly took to it faster than me because she was a few years older, and so we actually would take piano lessons together for several years. And I think, you know, as I started to come into my own a little more musically, she decided that maybe she'd be the one who's the athlete in the family. And she did very well at that.
I don't know the age at which one gets the Cook Scholarship, and how does that arise in summary?
So the Cook Scholarship, which provides a full-ride tuition to St. Paul's School in New Hampshire, it's offered only to Montana students. And so they recruit by sending somebody from the school with a video of the school and talk about what it offers in the middle schools. And I think you can apply for the first time in the 8th grade. I think you can also apply in 9th or 10th grade, and they can take you for subsequent years. But the normal applicants are in the 8th grade. So for me, that I think I was 13 years old when I applied for the Cook. Got it, and actually I was still 13 when I left Helena to go to St. Paul's.
Now, is St. Paul's noted as a music school?
It's not particularly a music school. No, it's a prep school, kind of in the broadest sense of a New England preparatory school. It's modeled on the English public school system. So morning chapel, required sports, education in humanities, language. But the arts are a big component of that.
What level were you at when you left? And what does St. Paul contribute to your music education?
Yeah, when I was an eighth grader still in Montana, I think I competed in the state music competition for piano performance. That was all classical music, so I prepared a recital of piano pieces, went to the state competition. I don't think I won, but I sort of thought, okay, this is fun to put together music and perform. So when I went to St. Paul's, that was all I intended to do, was study piano and keep doing recitals and classical music. But I quickly found out, oh, wait a minute, there's a choir made up of students that sings in the evening services, the morning services. That sounds like fun, so I tried out for the choir. Then there was a smaller subset of the choir called the Madrigal Singers that did more nuanced, more complicated a cappella arrangements. So I tried out for that, got into that. There were a cappella groups on campus all run by students, so when I tried out for that, I actually not only made it into the group, but I quickly became the group's arranger of songs. They were looking for somebody who could take a song that the group wanted to sing and actually come up with the parts that everybody would sing, something that I hadn't really ever done before.
An arranger of songs. Now, I think of a song as written, And I've never thought if you had a bunch of people, it took some organization to figure out who does what. That's what it sounds like. Is that fair?
Well, yes. I'd say broadly put, the arranger decides where to put things, where to put the notes. If a composer or writer has written a song, you know, in the classical tradition, everything would be committed to paper. Every note that the instrument would play, every dynamic. In a more pop or contemporary sense, you have a song that consists of a melody and supporting chords and maybe, you know, a lyric and a structure. But now, say it's played on the radio and we want to do it only with voices in an a cappella choir. So I listen to it and go, well, gee, okay, that's the bass line. So somebody has to sing the bass line. How about you sing the bass line? And now somebody has to sing the melody, so you sing the melody. And now we need everything in between. We need to hear what the chord is. We need to hear what the rhythm is, what the beat is. So then you figure out, the arranger says, how can we replicate that, or not even replicate, but reproduce and reimagine the beat and the harmony of the song using only the voices that we have. I mean, arranging is really about the limitations you have on you as well.
Hmm.
If everything could be arranged for full string orchestra and choir and it was never a concern, I think arrangers could be a little lazy. Oh yeah, have the strings play this, have the timpani play that. But say you gave an arranger, okay, you only have one violin and you have a triangle and you have a bass drum. Now make the song. Now the arranger has to get creative, because you say, well, geez, how am I going to bring the information of this melody and this harmony and this rhythm into these three instruments? And that's, I think, where arrangers can really show their creativity, when there's limitations.
Let me see if I understand. If you're Beethoven, you don't have an arranger. You've written down everything.
That's right.
Be some interpretation by the conductor and emphasis, but everything is there.
Right.
All right, but if you're Michael Jackson, the arranger, A, B, C, might produce a very different effect depending upon the tools and instruments and voices available to the arranger.
Absolutely. When you hear a Michael Jackson song, it's recognizable because of his voice that's singing, but it's also recognizable because of what the arranger put into that song, what the bass line is, where you hear this guitar lick come in. Those are the things we identify. So if I'm going to arrange a Michael Jackson song for an a cappella group, that's the stuff that my ear is listening for. These little audible kind of bits that you can, the highlights of the song, the audible highlights of the song. Now, you can't reproduce the entire song unless you had the original, you know, session and band from Michael Jackson's recording. But what you can do is take those highlights and reproduce them.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with Kurt Crowley, arranger and conductor of music. Now, it strikes me as a total layman that being an arranger is pretty sophisticated stuff. You've got to dissect and then integrate a whole series of things. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's absolutely fair. I would say the challenge of the composer is to kind of start from nothing and come up with a melody, come up with a lyric, come up with perhaps an arc of the song. The arranger then, of course, it depends on the composer. Some people, you know, continue to arrange their own songs, but if you hand it to an arranger, it's their job to go from there to the finished product that people are going to hear. So they decide, you know, when certain instrumentation is going to enter, what key the song is going to be in, whether this section should be shorter. What I love about it, though, is the composer's job seems very isolated. They're the ones who have to draw inspiration out of thin air. The arranger gets to draw inspiration from what already exists, from what the composer has produced already. And as I said a minute ago, they're limited by what means they have to achieve the end. And so it's a great kind of creative limitation. And it's also very collaborative.
Explain that. I mean, you're dealing with a people.
Right.
I assume they have an opinion.
Most composers don't usually just hand over their song and then forget about it. So they like to be involved along the way. Also, you have to think about your artists who are going to be performing it at the end. They also like to be involved along the way.
I thought perhaps that was the case. And my experience with artists is they have pride and professional sense of competence.
Mm-hmm.
Fair?
Fair.
So you're the man in the middle.
And really what I've learned is I've had a couple great arrangers as mentors while I've lived in New York City, and watching them, I really see what this skill is, not just the genius of creating this, of creating the arrangement, but how they collaborate with the composer and with the performers. And right off the bat, there's a lot of humility involved. There's a lot of understanding that you're there to serve the song, not to insert yourself into the song.
If I was to describe conductors, mm-hmm. I wouldn't describe them as modest people.
Right.
So this is a different thing.
I think so, because the conductor has a very visible position. Mm-hmm. As you say, most audiences, most lay people would know, oh, there's a conductor. He or she is in charge. He or she is doing something. An arranger, when their job is done well, should not be noticed at all. Hmm. You should say, I'm hearing a Michael Jackson song sung by this group. And you completely, mentally cut out this middleman who's done all this incredible work to create the arrangement.
Highly interesting concept. Can you give me an example?
An example about a year and a half ago, I was asked to create a song for Sesame Street to be used in a musical episode. The premise was that Cookie Monster was in this art museum where all the art was cookies, like the Mona Lisa made of cookies. And so what I was given from the crew at Sesame Street, the artistic crews, was exactly the lyrics that they wanted. This is what Cookie Monster says then. This is a spoken line. It's very, because they have a whole process they go through of making sure it's audience appropriate and has the right level of. So that's what I was handed. And then the musical arrangement was up to me. So I went away into my room and worked on my piano and my computer and came up with what I thought was a great draft. And I sent it to the music director, who's a friend of mine. And he came back and he said, try again.
He said, just try again.
Well, his notes were very general and blunt. He just said, it sounds too loungy. It sounds the wrong era. It needs to have more energy. Try it again. It was not micromanaging. He didn't tell me what to change or how to change. He just said, okay, do it again now. So again, the humility part is that I thought I had come up with something great and was told it doesn't fit what we're trying to do. And at that point, you know, if I were Beethoven, I would storm away and go, you know, say, well, this is my art, this is my work, I'll do what I want. But in this case, you know, it was a job. I was arranging a song, so I started over and I did a completely different version, trying to capture what he told me, more energy, less of an older style. And I think I did it again, and I got another set of notes that said closer. But
wow.
So gradually the notes got more specific about this or that section or key change. I had to be willing every time to either start over or scrap a lot of what I had done. I knew that's what the gig was. And so I'm helped in a way. You know, you said I was 31 at the beginning. I think being young can be a great asset, because I said, well, listen, I'm hungry for the experience. I don't have any chip on my shoulder, particular reputation to protect. He tells me to do it again, I'll do it again. I'll start over.
How much time cumulatively would you say you put in on that piece?
I'd say this was over a course of 2 or 3 weeks. And I probably spent, you know, 4 or 5 hours on each draft that I came up with. So maybe 20, 30 hours total for one song that it did eventually air on Sesame Street, this three-minute section.
And he bought it. He liked it.
And they liked it. They liked it a lot.
So from St. Paul, you go to Harvard. What do you study there?
I studied music and comparative religion.
And where did the comparative religion come from?
Well, I think I always knew music was going to be a part of it, since I'd been playing piano since age 4 and showed no signs of stopping. But I felt that I wanted to expand my horizons a little bit, to broaden myself in a sense. And the thought of coming out of college as a music major, I wouldn't say it scared me or had a stigma to it, but I thought, well, maybe there's something else along this road that I should just at least examine, because I know music is going to be a part of it. So I looked for something. What was important to me was to feel that it was something kind of cutting edge, that I wasn't just kind of burying myself in something historical, that I wanted to know, all right, this is the world we're living in now. And comparative religion seemed like something that was on the front page of the paper pretty much every day, what was happening in the Middle East with
sure.
Islam and Israel, and that was the invasion in Iraq was happening around then. So I thought, well, geez, if I can open myself up to what this has to offer, I didn't know that it was going to ever intersect with music. I would say I thought of it as a separate discipline.
I was going to ask you, because religion and music is closely intertwined in many cultures.
Yeah, and even I had grown up, you know, I grew up in Helena going to the cathedral and hearing the music, and I always loved, you know, the music was always one of my favorite parts of any religious ceremony. But the comparative religion discipline really presented itself as a humanities discipline, distinct from theology. So I really wanted to know what makes it tick, what makes all these religions kind of work linguistically and culturally.
And if I was to ask you what you learned...
As soon as I got into this study of, this interdisciplinary study of different religions, it dawned on me that, you know, if you meet somebody from a different country who speaks a different language, you can't get very far into knowing what their thoughts and feelings and priorities and behaviors are, because there's this fundamental block you can't get by. Well, similarly, even if you speak the same language, if you don't know anything about what their religious life is, what this practice might be, internal or external, I think you can't get very far into knowing what that person is about.
Interesting. My sense as a citizen, and you're talking about the period of the Iraq War, post-Iraq War, one hears about different religions, and our country is predominantly Christian, and what I would summarize what I hear generally or often is, well, those people are of a different religion. We can't get along with them. They have different views. What did you take away from your experience at Harvard in relation to that sort of perception?
I think the biggest thing that the coursework and talking to people and interviews and going through the comparative religion department was that it added depth to everything. I think reading what was in the papers every day, I can understand your perspective, what you're saying, that we perceived, for instance, the Middle East. We took this snapshot of it as being very backwards, very violent, very corrupt and kind of unable to move in contrast to the Western world. But what the discipline of understanding the history and the scripture and reading the poets, you know, the Muslim Sufi poets of the 13th century, I realized that 800 years ago the tides were turned pretty significantly. There were great libraries of learning in the Middle East. There were functioning governments. There were, you know, major projects of public works. And at the same period in Europe, people were probably, you know, in the Christian world, things were seen to be pretty backwards. And that's not the only example. I think there are many examples just where adding another dimension to the snapshot that we take of the world right now. You know, these religions are long. They cover long periods of human history. Even Islam is kind of the youngest major religion. It goes back to the year 600. So it'd be a little like only looking at people exactly the way they are now. Well, you're an old person. Well, you're a young... People have a long lives. And so I guess I understood that these religions, as we compare them, have long lives and change and evolve as they're lived.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with Kurt Crowley, music arranger and conductor, now working and living in New York City. So after Harvard, what?
When I graduated from Harvard, I applied for a fellowship to study in India. And I was able to go for 5 months. I lived in the Punjab, a state in northwest India.
Let me just interrupt you. Why India?
Well, as I said before, I studied music and comparative religion not knowing they would intersect. Well, it turns out Harvard had a curriculum requirement that they intersect. So in my senior year, I had to do what was called a joint thesis between the two departments of music and comparative religion. I had a wonderful advisor actually from Montana, Diana Eck, who said, well, music and religion, she said, obviously you have to study the Sikhs. And I said, the who? I think at this point I still didn't really understand anything about Sikhism. So she said, well, go find out. And so my senior thesis was on Sikh communities in Boston. Now, just to very briefly summarize, the central devotional practice of Sikhs, which are a kind of offshoot of Hinduism and Islam kind of that exists in between. It's a separate religion from both, but it started as a reform movement about 500 years ago. Their central devotional practice is musical. It would be as if you replace the scripture in a Christian church with only the hymn book. The central act is singing songs of devotion. And in that sense, music is fundamentally important to this whole tradition. Now, unfortunately for me, that music is Indian classical music, which I knew very little about. So in the course of uncovering things about Sikhism and trying to understand it, I had to start from the fundamentals and learn something about Indian classical music as well.
When I think of classical music, I think of Beethoven. He wasn't from India.
He was not.
Okay, so what's the difference? They both called classical music. Does that mean old, time-tested?
It does certainly mean old. In the case of North Indian classical music, we're talking about traditions that are thousands of years old that intersected with the Persian tradition as it was brought to India in, you know, a repeated series of invasions throughout the 1300s, 1400s, 1500s, and they fused into this tradition. What's classical about it is it requires years and years of study to even become decent at. The most accomplished classical musicians study their entire lives, belong to these kind of very exclusive teaching communities of how the tradition is passed on. Also, the way it's like classical music here is that only about 1% of the population really pays any attention to it, if not less. It's not popular music. It's not something that's listened to by a lot of lay people, I would say.
There now.
But it has centuries-long tradition, and I would say even though people don't listen to it, they recognize its importance in Indian culture. They treat it as a part of their heritage. And just to go one step further, since I already introduced Sikhism to it, even Indian classical music is seen to have a spiritual element to it.
Now, when you say a spiritual element, what do you mean?
Well, this is, remember, an outsider talking about it after 5 months in India. But to me, what I would take away from it is that music was not just played for the senses, for the ear to hear and the brain to process. To go to a concert to listen to a piece of Indian classical music being sung was meant to go beyond those senses and give you a kind of transformative experience. In the Sikh tradition, as I said, everything was sung according to these classical ragas, and it struck me as analogous to a kind of technology of how to access something beyond our normal experience. And that's why I think music is so important to religions in India.
You use the word spiritual, and I think in terms of your experience in Helena listening to music in the cathedral as also spiritual, an attempt to have the music elevate one's sense of self to be in touch with something beyond normal life, perhaps divine. What's the difference?
I would say that in the Catholic cathedral, the tradition that I grew up in, the music, as I said, was certainly something that elevated me in my experience, but it was meant to elevate the whole liturgy. It was meant to elevate the scripture and the different rites that were being done in the church. In India, I think the music itself replaces everything else. It is the one thing that is elevating you, the main thing. And people come just for that experience, for the music, as it is a vehicle to move them. It's not just helping.
That's a very powerful comment about the potency of music in certain cultures. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And it's something that the experience of that in India is something that I've carried with me, at least having had a brush with it, having had an experience with it. The picture that comes into my head is the tip of the iceberg. I learned that the music you see and hear is sometimes only the tip of the iceberg of what's really there.
Why New York, and how did you get there?
New York to me represented a place that I always thought I might end up living. I grew up around a theater here in Montana, and doing theater and doing musical theater always appealed to me. I would say that I faced a bit of a crossroads after India into whether I would continue into a PhD track of musicology, but I wasn't done being a performer. So in a sense, I fell back on the type of music performing that I knew, which was musical theater. I briefly moved to Portland, Oregon, where I started working in regional theaters, learned about music directing, and then I thought, well, it's that now or never. Time to go to New York if I'm going to do musical theater. That's the center of it all.
So what have you found in New York that's similar and different to your experience in Portland?
The biggest difference is the pace and the number of people doing what we're doing. If in Portland there were 3 or 4 projects that I could do in a year, in New York there's 3 or 4 a week. The density of creative people and projects people are working on in New York astounded me, even though I was expecting it. And so I kind of very quickly hit the ground running, saying yes to everything that I possibly could, trying to get experience any way I could, watching everybody in the room. As soon as I got into the room in a project, watching how people behaved, how they talked, how they organized their time. And things very quickly led to one another.
The implication is people don't have trouble with outsiders in New York, or just you're a nice guy and fit in.
I think there are a lot of outsiders in New York. There are a lot of people that come there kind of chasing the dream, wanting to be part of the big kind of bubbling cauldron that is New York City. But I do think that coming in with a real willingness to learn, and not just learn techniques, but learn about the projects people were working on. In the first 4 years I was in New York, I had to learn how to play salsa music. I had to learn to play in a hip-hop musical. I had to be able to confidently fake my way through jazz charts. And I was willing to kind of start from the bottom and learn how to do it each time. I even had the chance of being a real neophyte when I ended up working on a musical in Cuba, where I was facing not only learning a lot about Cuban music, but having to do it in a different language. And that was very humbling, but it taught me an incredible amount. And I actually think my experience being in India and interacting with a different culture really served me well there.
You're now involved with Hamilton, which is a blockbuster, as I understand it, musical in New York about Alexander Hamilton.
That's right.
How's the experience?
The experience is thrilling on every level. The highs are very high. Getting to do the show for people every night is incredible. It strikes me that, given what we've talked about leading up in this conversation, being a kid from Montana, it's a little strange that I'm involved in this show, given Montana's estate didn't even exist when this piece of American and New York history happened, and also that the story is told through a lot of hip-hop culture, which is not something, it's something that we think of as belonging more to urban settings, and not something that I was really exposed to in Montana growing up.
You live in a very fast-paced world now in New York City. Why do you come back to Montana?
Oh, it's so important to me to get to come back to Montana as much as I can. And I think the biggest thing is it's not even just so much the pace. As I'm thinking about it now, it's the noise. Huh. You know, as a musician, I'm trained to react to sound. And New York is a noisy place, and there's a lot of clamor, and there's a lot of voices, and there's a lot of opinions. And when I come to Montana and stand in these wide open spaces, there are many fewer noises, and blocking out some of those noises and getting away from some of those allows me to reflect and focus on what really is important. What are my priorities? Which sounds and voices matter the most to me, including in my own head?
Kurt Crowley, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian. It was a pleasure.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.